Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. In a 1958 television interview, Mike Wallace asked philosopher, psychoanalyst, best-selling author, and one of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century, Erich Fromm, why he thinks we're missing out on real love. He asked Fromm why it's so difficult for us to be in love.
Because we are concerned with things, we are concerned with success, we are concerned with money, we are concerned with instrumentalities. And the most important things we talk about on Sundays are things to which we pay very little attention. Love is not easy. All great religions postulate love as one of the greatest accomplishments. If it were that easy, or as easy as most people think, certainly the great religious leaders would have been rather naive.
In a new biography about Fromm, The Lives of Erich Fromm, Love's Prophet, Harvard professor and author Lawrence Friedman recalls that interview and Fromm's connections to love. Professor Friedman joins us now to talk about that. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Hi. Good to be here, Ann.
The title of the book alone raises at least two questions. The Lives of Erich Fromm. You use the word lives instead of life. What's the significance of that?
Well, I think one sees it in the Mike Wallace interview. Wallace introduces Fromm as the greatest psychoanalyst since Freud, but Fromm does other things. Fromm is a philosopher, as you've noted. Fromm is active in politics. Fromm is part of the tradition of rabbinic scholars. The reason I call it lives is because he does an enormous amount of activity in different areas. Going to the subtitle, Love's Prophet, that's the solution to everything, love on a deep level.
You listened to the Mike Wallace interview with Erich Fromm when it first aired, and that influenced you.
It sure did. I was 18 years old, about to go to college, and I listened with my grandfather, and it was absolutely fascinating. So I said to my grandfather, "Who is this guy?" And he pointed to the shelves and said, "The guy, we've had his books for years. You just don't bother to put your hand up and grab a book." And from that point, I took all his books to college, and I've been reading them since.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lawrence Friedman. He's a professor at Harvard University and the author of The Lives of Erich Fromm, Love's Prophet. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The title of his first book, written in 1941, Escape from Freedom, discusses the individual fear of freedom and explains how the likes of, I guess, Nazism and other dictatorships helped so many achieve that. Was that the first book you read, or did you start with...
No, I started with the first book we all do,
right.
Art of Loving, which sold 25 million copies. It's still selling. But in a sense, it's the opposite to Escape from Freedom. Mm-hmm. Escape from Freedom is about why, as he wrote it as an emigre from the Holocaust, there was Hitler, there was Stalin, Mussolini, all Europe seemed to have gone fascist. And by Escape from Freedom, it was a totalitarian appeal. Essentially, he argued you under totalitarian appeals, one steps on the person below and salutes the dictator above. And I might say that this book is very relevant to us today. Every time you see a revolt against a dictator, beginning in the Hungarian Revolt of 1956 against the Soviets, right through to today where we found Arab Spring, and the revolts against dictators there, people are reading Escape from Freedom. One example should suffice. In Tunisia, in Tunis, the capital city, as a dictatorship, Fromm was barred. There's a bookstore, a huge bookstore, right across from the National Police Office. No Fromm books before the revolt, after it's full of Fromm books and everyone's reading Escape from Freedom. So it has a currency going up to today.
It helps people understand how they got themselves in that situation?
Yes, it does. I think Fromm is saying, if you know when you're going against love, you know when you're doing the wrong thing and hurting others, and you need some kind of a movement toward democracy to be able to act on that feeling. And he believes it can happen anywhere in the world.
Going back to The Art of Loving, you said it sold some 25 million copies, and it's still selling today, as you mentioned, you know, wherever there's that construct of society. And also, you know, there's always another college student out there. Has that book stood the test of time?
It's still selling. I mean, my students prefer Art of Loving to Escape from Freedom, which I consider a deeper book. And just a comment on why it sells, and I think will always sell. There's a resonance of authenticity. You know there's truth there. In essence, the argument is that to have genuine life, love, you have to love the self, love another, and love all of society. And as he's coming up with that theme, he is, for the first time in his life, genuinely in love. He's engaged. He writes to his wife-to-be, Anise Freeman, 6-7 times a day. When they're together, he goes back, gets her a box of candy, forgets a few hours that he's done that, buys her another box of candy. They're writing back and forth even when they're living together, married. There's genuine authenticity in that book because there is at the time in Fromm's life. The love letters go right into the book.
But he believed that long before he met his third wife, right?
Yes, I think he did, but Art of Loving is in 56.
Mm-hmm.
He gets married in 1953, and it carries through. He's writing the book while he's in love and writing the love letters. And even after he's married to her, they send little notes back and forth, 6, 7, 8 every day. I think he believed in the concept of love as an idea in his head considerably before. But I think it becomes something deep felt, something that appeals to millions as he was in the process of really falling in love.
A big part of the story about him, or in some people's minds, is his departure from Freud as a psychoanalyst. Can you talk about that conflict?
Yes. I think actually Fromm once said he had a dance with Freud, not an opposition. He was started out a Freudian. But by the late 1930s, there was a difference. Freud essentially argued that we have within us deep, powerful inner drives. And those drives come out and have to be restrained by superego factors that press the drives back so that society can function. And in Freud's words, you create a necessary discontent. People are frustrated, unhappy. Fromm differed from this. He said we can be doggone happy. Whatever drives or whatever that comes out of us is shaped by the social circumstances around us. And you create decent circumstances, nurturing parents, a sense of community, an atmosphere of love and caring, and people come out just fine and happy. Fromm's much more optimistic than Freud.
Why was it such a big deal back then if they disagreed? There were these camps.
That's a good question. Freud was the founder. And Freud insisted that everyone agree or you were expelled from the movement. Fromm was, in essence, expelled later on, not so much by Freud, who admired Fromm, but by the followers of Freud. it's silly, Ian. I mean, this fighting among the Freudians is very silly. They ought to be exchanging ideas.
And to what extent did it affect his career then when you disagree with the big guy at the time?
Well, initially, it affected his career, I think, negatively. But he went and created his brand of psychoanalysis in Mexico. Mexican analysts and psychologists are Frommians. So he created an alternative world. And I think currently, Fromm has it over an orthodox Freud. Most practitioners, especially psychoanalysts, look to him stressing society, interpersonal relationships, and find it more comfortable in dealing with patients than they find Freud. In the end, I think Fromm won.
I think it's interesting that he moved to Mexico and did all that work there, and he worked on, did a study of a small village in Mexico,
yes.
and there were people that he had hired to collect the data, and they said, well, we can't. These people are illiterate. You can't do that in this kind of a situation. He finally found someone to work on it, but nowadays, that happens quite a bit, research like that. It's more narrative, but it does happen.
Yes, you're right. The story there is in this study of a Mexican village about 50 miles south of Mexico City. There was mass poverty, high alcoholism, and general lethargy. Don't want to do much of anything. And Fromm's the study was why did it was this occurring? And initially, he had a group of some folklorists who were doing just what you're saying, were looking at and observing and telling the stories of the people in the village to capture life on their own terms. And then subsequently, he fired the folklorists, and he went much more psychoanalytic in his own form of psychoanalysis. And I think he wasn't as much capturing the story as did the folklorist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time, Oscar Lewis writes Children of Sanchez, which sold in the millions, movies, operas, and Lewis followed the story. Fromm's researcher started off, and he cut it off. This was a mistake, and this is the only book by Eric Fromm sold less than a million copies.
My guest is Lawrence Friedman. He's a professor at Harvard University and the author of a new biography of Eric Fromm. It's called The Lives of Eric Fromm, Love's Prophet. If you have a question or comment for Lawrence Friedman, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today on 89.7 NPR News, 58 degrees, with a mix of sun and clouds and a chance of thunderstorms later today, a high near 71. There's a chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight as well, a low of 56 degrees. The mild temperatures continue along with that chance of showers and thunderstorms on Tuesday, and a high of 74. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support comes from Marburn Academy, a leader in college preparatory education for ADHD and dyslexic students. Hosting a community parent seminar, ADHD Students and the Role of Medication. It's April 9th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Lawrence Friedman. He's a professor at Harvard University and the author of a new book about Eric Fromm. It's called The Lives of Eric Fromm, Love's Prophet. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. It's noted in several reviews of the book, Larry, that there are revelations in it that no one else has either taken the time to unearth or couldn't. What access did you have to Eric Fromm's papers, to his letters? I know many of them were destroyed. How did you flesh this out?
Well, first of all, the archives of Fromm are in Tübingen, Germany, near Stuttgart. And I was asked to do the biography by the literary executor, Rainer Funk. So I had access, a huge archive, took many years to go through all the letters. Since the wife burned some of those letters, the issue was, how do you get that information? And I discovered something I never knew before. You can't actually burn letters. Somebody sends a letter to somebody else. Fromm would send a letter to, say, sociologist friend David Riesman. Here in Cambridge, there are 400 letters between them at the Harvard Archive. You just have to run all over the world to get the missing letters. Then, of course, you have to interview all over the world people who knew him at one time or another. And I found that in the interview process, people pull out of their attic or whatever more letters. So it takes a lot of time, but it's a lot of fun. And you find things you never knew before. Nobody has known. You want an example or two?
Yes, please.
Okay. We all know John F. Kennedy. Well, in 1960, Kennedy, of course, is running for president against Nixon. And he picks up an issue of a magazine called Daedalus. And in that magazine, Fromm has an article on how you basically should conduct foreign policy, especially with the Soviets, that you should take a big step toward getting rid of nuclear weapons, propagandize globally for the Soviets to match that step, take another big step, pressure the Soviets. Kennedy reads this during the campaign, and he goes to the editor of Daedalus, Gerald Holton, and said, "Is this the Fromm who wrote Escape from Freedom?" "Yes, it is." "Well, where can I get in contact with him?" Well, they made contact during the campaign. Kennedy, at Fromm's advice, pledges a powerful new disarmament agency for the U.S. if elected. Within a year of being elected, Kennedy creates it. Then Kennedy insists on a spectrum of foreign policy advisors with different views who advise on every issue. Fromm is the dove in that spectrum. So he has quite an impact on Kennedy foreign policy. Then the big one occurs. We all know 50 years ago, the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred, a Soviet-U.S. standoff that almost obliterated the globe. And about a week later, Kennedy called Fromm and basically asked, how do I avoid this? How do we avoid blowing up the world? And Fromm told him, you take it stage by stage. Then Kennedy's most important foreign policy speech in June of 1963, shortly, he's going to be assassinated some months later. But what does he do? He says, you may not like the Soviets, but you got to deal with them or we're going to all blow up. And then underscores right from the magazine article the step-by-step approach. Fromm has a decided influence on Kennedy that I never knew about. I can give you other examples.
Well, there's Adlai Stevenson. There's George McGovern.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I was a part of, probably a lot of us were, in 1968, as the Vietnam War got worse and worse, Gene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota.
I'm sorry, Gene McCarthy, yeah.
Ran for to challenge Lyndon Johnson in the Democratic primary, McGovern being a peace candidate. Well, what I didn't know is that Eric Fromm funded that campaign and advised McCarthy on every foreign policy issue. One can go on and on in areas one has no knowledge of before. He knows, as you're pointing out, he knows personally Adlai Stevenson. He's one of Senator Fulbright of Arkansas's best friends. And Fulbright is the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And you go on and on. This is a man of enormous political influence that nobody has known. I was really lucky and fortunate to get this.
Enormous political influence, and yet in academia, especially American academia, or maybe only American academia, he is not highly regarded.
No, he's not. And it's only in American academia. Academics and everywhere else globally, they love Eric Fromm. Why not in America? Well, I'm going to give an opinion here that American academics, especially in the last three decades, have become extremely specialized and not speaking to a general audience out there, not even wanting to speak to a general audience, but just to colleagues of their own specialty. Fromm speaks to millions. So the retort among American, at least some American academics on this count, is that he's not specialized enough, he's not expert enough. Fromm is what we now call a public intellectual, who appeals to people all over. Most American academics don't have that. They're very narrow and talk to each other. I think that's the source. I think there's a more of a respect in other countries among academics and other parts of the culture for not only Eric Fromm, but public intellectuals generally. This, to me, I'd rather sell millions of books and give it to causes, good causes like Amnesty International, peace groups, and so forth, than to be a narrow specialist talking to others in that same specialty.
How do you think he developed that way? What was it, something in his childhood? How did he step off onto that path?
Okay, great question. In fact, they're all terrific. What happened is Fromm, who was born in Frankfurt, had a very unhappy childhood. That he basically had a manic father, we would call, and a deeply depressed mother. And he was between them. Well, to get out, he studies with, at first, rabbis, other Talmudic scholars, and it makes him, gives him something to lift him from that household. Well, the rabbinic tradition is not narrow, it's broad. You're trying to elaborate the Old Testament and other stories, and that draws him into a general appeal. His most beautiful book, I think, is Ye Shall Be as Gods, which comes out in the mid-60s, and it's reading the Old Testament like it was music. It's a beautiful book, and it shows how far in this rabbinic tradition Fromm has gone. So I would take his speaking to broad audiences out of this development in the rabbinic tradition.
My guest is Lawrence Friedman. He's the author of a new biography of Eric Fromm. It's called The Lives of Eric Fromm, Love's Prophet. If you have a question or comment for Lawrence Friedman, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. There's an email from Bob in Westerville. He says, where does Fromm's work fit with that of the critical theory developed by his better-known colleagues at the Frankfurt School? Do you feel that the Marxist origins of the Frankfurt School affect general acceptance of Fromm's insights? And if so, how?
That's a wonderful question. It's also a hard question.
Well, first of all, the Frankfurt School was in Germany.
Yes, in Frankfurt. This is a group of intellectuals who work within a building. The chair is a man named Horkheimer, and they work on various projects. Fromm was brought in 1928 to teach psychoanalysis, psychological theories, and so forth, and because there was a desire to merge Marx with psychoanalysis. Well, Fromm in that Frankfurt School was kind of a loner. He starts out, his first big project is a research project based on empirical material to understand who Hitler is starting to appeal to. This is before Hitler becomes chancellor. And he's very worried because he thinks that the German working class could flip and become supporters of fascism. So he goes that way. It's the only big survey research project in the Frankfurt School. And another thing is the Frankfurt School is more concerned with abstractions, abstract Marx, abstract Freud. Fromm is concerned with social circumstances, and let's analyze them. Fromm got his PhD in the mid-20s in sociology, not in psychoanalysis. The social structure is central. He's getting enormous stimulation when you have a Horkheimer, an Adorno, and so forth in the Frankfurt School, but he's going his own way. And I might say, just another aside, we need to say a few negative things about Fromm here for some balance.
Okay.
And what I think happens after he leaves the Frankfurt School, he's getting really hard criticism of his writing, and it makes them better. But as he leaves the Frankfurt School, he gets around him a bunch of yes people more and more who say praise but don't tightly criticize. And he becomes more self-referential, drawing on his own material. The Frankfurt School was great for him because it gave him criticisms, tough criticisms. He needed that all his life. It's no accident that at the Frankfurt School, you have the roots of his best book, Escape from Freedom. You never have something of that level afterward. So Frankfurt was a wonderfully important experience for him.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air with Lawrence Friedman. Welcome, Jerome.
Thank you. Enjoying the program very much. Professor Friedman, I just wanted to follow up on your comment about why Fromm is not so well known in the United States. And this is based on my own graduate school experience and my current research and writing. It seems to me also that there has been a war going on about Freud. You look at, for example, Elaine Showalter on the one side trying to rehabilitate Freud, and then in the cognitive neuroscience, Ramachandran trying to destroy Freud. And then in different departments of the university, you can, you know, Freud is interpreted through so many different people. Lacan on one side, Eric Erickson on the other, Fromm even in some departments, and everyone's trying to claim Freud one way or another. So everyone else, all the others, such as Fromm, become sort of a pawn in this game as people are trying to claim dominance in their interpretation of Freud. And at least that's just based on my experience and my reading. And I was wondering, it is, I think, indicative of the problems in American academia right now. As you said, the specialization contributes to that. And you can't have these discussions from department to department. You mentioned Erickson in some critical theory department, and they'll look at you like the man from the moon.
Lawrence Friedman?
Okay, very good. I wrote a biography of Erik Erickson before Fromm, and they're both enormously creative, and they both have this terrible problem in academia. Just this short one on Erickson. Erickson had no degrees whatsoever, and he was proposed to be a professor at Harvard. Well, the faculty voted him down. So his friend, David Reisman, also Fromm's friend, went to the dean and said, you know, you hire Erickson, you'll probably hire, next to William James, the best professor in Harvard history. He did, and that's exactly what happened. So that's to the problem of academe. Now, where Fromm is in terms of Freud, it's a complicated situation. There has been, as you mentioned with Showalter and others, a revival, a claiming of Freud. But one has to ask what Freud they're reclaiming. And I think it's an altered Freud. In other words, everyone has a need to pick out of Freud what they want. And there's a revival of that. Let me, though, note that today, what the practitioners are doing, and they're picking up on Fromm's interpersonal theory, or what he called central relatedness, the connectedness of people to each other. That is the big thing in journals, of especially those that are psychoanalytic and social. Neuroscience, something should be made here. Fromm's last book, coming out in the 70s, was called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. He's in his 70s when he writes that, and he has learned neuroscience and is using it to explain why human beings attack each other. Try to do that. I'm in my 70s, so I'm having trouble learning neuroscience. So that's the unit I'm in. He's growing. He's growing all the time. And he can be stigmatized by some, not by others. But I wish those who stigmatize him and use the label neo-Freudian, whatever that means, would read him.
Jerome, thanks a lot for that question. My guest is Lawrence Friedman. He is the author of a new biography about Erik Fromm. It's called The Lives of Erik Fromm. Love's Prophet. We'll return to our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Jobs and the Sequester, we'll look at the new dip in job creation. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. And stay with us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of All Sides begins, and a discussion of how the Jewish faith changed after the Holocaust. That's from 11 till noon today on 89.7 NPR News. There is a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm this afternoon, mainly after 3 p.m., and will reach a high of 71 today. A chance of rain for tonight, a low of 56. Still possible with showers and thunderstorms on Tuesday, and a high of 74. Support for All Sides comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, presenting a new take on the tragic tale of Carmen. Performances of an unconventional chamber version take place April 13th and 14th at Ohio State's Thurber Theater. More information at music.osu.edu. And support comes from OSU's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can improve the outcome of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey and how to opt out of the study, are at protectiii.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about Eric Fromm with Lawrence Friedman, the author of a new biography of Eric Fromm. It's called The Lives of Eric Fromm, Love's Prophet. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our email and post your question or comment there. I wanted to get back to Fromm's connection to the Jewish faith. He approached it mostly as an academic in later life, although spirituality is a component of humanism in a way, but not God necessarily. How did that all fit in his brain?
Well, that's another great and rough question, man. He starts out as really a teenager studying under rabbis. He goes and advances in studies under very prominent rabbis. Fromm is becoming a scholar of the Old Testament. You look at text, you absorb it, you make comments on it, you read very carefully. He's, in essence, becoming the Eric Fromm we know by becoming a very critical analyst of text. Then he does his dissertation at the University of Heidelberg in sociology with Alfred Weber, Max Weber's brother, and who was an opponent of the Nazis. And Weber lets him do whatever he wants. So he writes his dissertation basically on Hasidic Jewry. And he gravitates there because he sees in the Hasidics more spontaneity, love, caring, excitement than any other branch of Judaism. And that's in some measure where that the spirituality, the love of life, the love of love, comes into play. And Fromm never ceases to be that Talmudic scholar, looking at text. Every morning of his life, he looks at text, he analyzes it, and he writes about it. That's part of his day-to-day tradition. So I would think it's very important for him. One never talked about Fromm without some reference to the Old Testament and its elaborators. Now, let me give you one related story, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Fromm has moved as an emigre to the U.S., to New York, by 1934. Most of his family stay in Germany. Well, that family, as Hitler, things get worse, Kristallnacht and so forth, the family is leaving all over the world. And only one of his aunts, Sophie Englander, and her husband remain in Berlin, saying, Berlin is our city, it's not Hitler's city. Well, they know they're goners in time. But Sophie Englander begins a newsletter, and she gets it somehow beyond Nazi censors. And every member of that family, Fromm included, dispersed all over the world, writes bits on family life, child is born and so forth. That newsletter keeps the family together. Fromm always writes in that newsletter, and he frames their dispersed existence from text, mainly Old Testament text, which is hopeful, which is spiritual. It goes down very, very deep in his life. If I wanted a single theme, it would be love, but the second theme would be a spirituality based on Old Testament values.
I read that he criticized American religious life, and I wondered if you could talk about that, and also whether that included American Jewish religious life.
Okay. I would frame it this way. Fromm sees the Jewish Talmudic tradition, and the core of Judaism historically, as ethical relationships between people. It's quite secondary if there's a God out there or whatever you label it. You have to be ethical and caring and loving in your conduct for others. And that, he sees, is the Jewish Talmudic tradition. He finds that in a number of ways people profess religions, there's not that concern with for what you do on earth day to day. There's more an abstraction that he sees gets in the way of it. Now, he has many friends who are quite religious. The Trappist monk, Thomas Merton, friends who are Hasidics, friends who are active in the civil rights movement, who are Baptists or Methodists. But the big issue is how you relate to each other, and it doesn't matter what you call it. Fromm has trouble with the concept of God, as do a number of people, because he sees, he asks himself, how could there be a God given what Hitler did? The presence of Darwinian evolutionary theory gives him problems. But he said, others can have that. That's fine. Just ethical conduct in the here and now, concretely.
Email sent from Hal. He says, it sounds as though together Freud and Fromm represented what are now described as right and left-sidedness in the brain, or in religious and political terms, being driven by fear alongside being driven by love. Am I right?
Yes, and when you look at those two sides, you might have Jung. animus, animi. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think so. You know, they met in, I think it was 1928 in Baden-Baden. The only time they met, we don't know what they said to each other. We do know they spent a whole day together. And you don't do that with anybody unless there's something interesting in the other. And it very well may have been, and this fear versus love, this caring versus this antagonism. I would suspect it is.
Ralph in Columbus, you're on the air with Lawrence Friedman. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thank you so much, Ann. Great show. Dr. Friedman, this has been a delightful trip down memory lane for me. When I was 10 years old, my parents were reading Art of Loving as part of one of their Sunday school classes. I was afraid seeing the title that they were going to take a trip to Haight-Ashbury or something, but that's a different matter. By the time I was 16, I had to be dragged out of a bookstore, mad as all get out, because they wouldn't let me buy the hardcover copy of Anatomy of Human Destruction. When I think of Fromm's view of society from, say, the sane society up to anatomy, I have my thoughts about how he changed in that, but I'd be very interested to hear your perspective.
How can you clarify again that last?
How his view of society changed as he went on through his life.
Okay, great, wonderful question.
Well, Anne's hitting you with great generalizations. I'll do
well. Everybody.
Thank you, Ralph.
I'll need a nap after this. the view did change. Obviously, when you're dealing with the Holocaust and you have to leave, you have a very negative view. But it's well to note, even in that period, he had a hope, and Escape from Freedom indicates it, in democracy and tolerance and so forth, as the counterpoint to what he sees there. Later on, he is a founder in the early 60s of Amnesty International. And you see that same split that I think Ann noted a few minutes ago between all the governments. Amnesty was founded in 62 because of all the terrible actions globally against people with government sanctions. And he was the principal funder of Amnesty. And that was, again, the horror, but also the hope. He came up by the mid-60s with the notion of biophilia necrophilia. Biophilia is the love of the life process, the love of others. Necrophilia is the proclivity to death, to destruction, a Hitler. I think your wonderful question, you get through from a kind of a balance. Horrors are occurring, but hopes are occurring. And with the hopes, there's always the possibility to turn things around. And I might just peripherally have a note of something that wasn't brought up. I should have earlier. And that is, Fromm's books sold and made him millions of dollars. But every cent of it, every single penny of it, he gave away to organizations promoting life. Not only Amnesty, the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, various peace candidates, various efforts in Central Europe to break the Soviet clampdown. He used his money to make for a better world that he thought was possible. And the last point here is, if I were to give a single theme of Fromm's accomplishment, I would call him an educator for the world. The books circle the entire world. Pope John the 23rd calls him one of the greatest teachers of all time. This is a person whose ideas, the despair but also the hope, are listened to globally and still are, frankly.
Ralph, thanks a lot for that call. We have a few minutes left if you want to make a quick call, 614-292-8513. We have an email from John. He writes, I learned of Fromm because he wrote the introduction or something at the end in the classic 1984, which was required reading in my high school, which Larry makes me want to run back and check out my copy of 1984 to see if that's the case. But it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Let me, before we go off the air, and note that one of the causes Fromm gave a lot of money to was public radio, stations like yours, that he really believed in the institutions, art institutions, public radio, what have you, that make people play their best game, so to speak.
Thank you very much for saying that. Let's see, Michael. Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
And thanks for a great program. I was a seminary student in 1970 and was doing a paper on humanism and Erich Fromm. And I had my first major crisis of faith. But I continued with those graduate studies in existentialism. We studied Heidegger and Sartre, read Being in Time. But luckily, I also took a course in Paul Tillich, who described how in accepting one's faith, there was always going to be a crisis first, because that had to happen in order to really make it your own. And I credit Erich Fromm and his humanism in making my faith more mature. I've now been a music minister for 40 years, but started then, it was very difficult when it was happening, because he said all the right things and God was not in his picture, but he made my biblical studies more mature, and I think made everyone who studied the Bible, because of his great humanism, a more mature approach. And I got to get this book.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm glad you're a Fromm fan. Terrific.
You know, when I was reading about Fromm to prepare for this program, I was reading about one of three escape mechanisms he describes, one of them, the automaton conformity. And at the same time, I was listening to an NPR program about old time Hollywood, and which would have been during his time creating automatons, when the studios made actors change their names and their true selves to achieve some sort of idea.
Yeah, it sure did. But I think some of you have read the book The Lonely Crowd by David Reisman, which sold about as much as Fromm did. And every undergraduate when I went to school read that. That was right out of Fromm, and Reisman admits it. It was the danger of conformity, what Reisman called other direction, Fromm called automaton conformity, and the need for digging into the inner direction, the inner self, which is what Fromm called a viable social character. So Fromm manifests his thoughts in a variety of ways. One need not during college have read Fromm. Mm-hmm. One will probably have read Reisman book, Escape Lonely Crowd. A number of people, as some of your listeners have underscored, have picked up and found Fromm useful, inspiring along the way.
Lawrence Friedman, that is all the time we have for this. Thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It really has been fun, and the questions have been terrific.
It's Lawrence Friedman. He is author of a new biography. It's called The Lives of Erich Fromm, Love's Prophet. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.